attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Kevin Chesters. His social media bio says he's a, quote, tall, bald bloke from Penzance. And whilst that might be true, it does rather undersell the fact that perched atop that tall body and in that bald bonce are some serious smarts. Kevin is a chief strategy officer, formerly strategy head at Ogilvy, Whedon & Kennedy, Saatchi, Dentsu, with a client-side cameo at BT, a visiting lecturer in creativity at several universities, a TEDx speaker, co-author of The Creative Nudge, and an absolute advocate for storytelling. Once upon a time, Kevin said, if you look up the word creative in any dictionary, it will never mention poetry, painting, dancing, art, and so on. Being creative is about doing new, original things, and that's what's absolutely key. Anyone can be creative. You could be an original thinking lawyer, an original thinking teacher, or a creative thinking mum. Anyone can do it. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Giles.
Right, 7 quick fires. Coke or Pepsi?
Pepsi.
Dog called Pepsi. Number 2, Cornwall or Eno Land?
It was Eno and you dropped the...
Eno and. I've even written it down. Eno
top
and.
Of every word. I would say Eno and.
Perfect. Agency side or client side?
Both for different reasons.
Right, music now. Coming Up by Suede or American Idiot by Green Day?
Coming Up by Suede.
Right, advertising ones now. Skoda Cake or Cadbury's Eyebrows?
Cake.
This might sound a bit rogue to unfamiliar listeners. The Women's Institute or the Hell's Angels?
The Women's Institute.
And then what would you rather? England win the Euros or Bromley get promoted?
Bromley have already been promoted, so I would do Euros.
What about Bromley get promoted again or England win the Euros?
England win the Euros. I've waited 50 years for that. I haven't waited that long for Bromley.
Okay. Nice. You sailed through those. Kevin, thanks for joining us. As you know, and as we've just touched on pre-recording, actually, we like to start the show by asking the guests to talk to us about their path to where they are now, including first jobs and, you know, first ever proper jobs. So can you tell us a bit about that?
How far do you want to go back with first job?
All the way.
I worked on a vegetable stall just outside of Penzance when I was 11, which I think was probably illegal, but that was my first job. I worked for £1.50 an hour, and in the summer I did a 40-hour week for £60, which at the time I thought I was Rockefeller.
Yeah.
We should probably talk about proper job. I mean, my first proper job in this industry was as a grad at a regional agency in the Midlands. I'd waited for a year to get a job. I'd left university. I tried to get a job. I sent off so many letters because back then there was no such thing as LinkedIn, email, mobile phones, the web. So you sent off letters and then waited feverishly to get, you know, letters. And you learned that if you got an A4 envelope, it meant it was good news. And if you got a manila envelope, you know, a thin envelope, it was bad news. I sent off loads of applications, probably over 150, didn't get anywhere. Finally got a job after a year of counting Christmas cards into packs of 10 and pushing a broom around a warehouse, which knocked some of the university hubris out of me. I then got a job. I got sacked after that job, out of that job in 10 months for being a bit rubbish. So 2 years after graduating, I was living on a mate's spare room floor, signing on the dole in Victoria. And then randomly, just to show you that it can happen anyway, I met a girl at an all-you-can-eat curry night in Moseley in Birmingham, who told me about an agency in London that employed literally anyone as long as you sent them a letter. So I did, got a job. They kept you on for a week. They gave you £100 and a travel card. And if you were any good, they kept you on. The punchline to that would be that I stayed there for a week, but I didn't. It kind of was an agency that no longer exists. It eventually became part of ARC, but it doesn't exist anymore. It was a bit of a shambles. And it was such a shambles that people kept leaving all the time. So I went from being the trainee to being an account exec to being an account manager to being a senior account manager in about 5 months. So then I was sort of able to fast track my career. I applied for a job at Ogilvy from that job and got it. So I was employed as a senior account manager at Ogilvy when I'd been out of university for about 2.5 years. So weirdly, had I got a job at Ogilvy as a grad trainee, I probably wouldn't have progressed as fast as I did through the warehouse, getting sacked, signing on, and then going to the shambles agency.
Amazing.
Via a very circuitous route, I ended up at a proper agency in a proper job. But in the meanwhile, I'd also applied for a series of other jobs through being very disillusioned. I applied for a job as a Virgin Atlantic cabin crew, but got turned down because I'm an inch too tall. And I applied for various things, accountancy, selling crisps in Sunderland. But anyway, I ended up at Ogilvy, which is sort of how I ended up in the inverted commas career that I'm in now.
Before we go into too much detail about Ogilvy, if we just rewind that slightly, prior to even going to university, was there any intention or was there any kind of allure that advertising had to you? Or was it something that, as you say, was just one of many options, including potentially becoming an air steward?
I mean, absolutely none whatsoever. So I have an encyclopedic knowledge of adverts from the late 70s and through the 80s. The reason I do is A, I'm autistic, and B, I watched a lot of television. And of course, there were only 3 television stations in most of my childhood. But no, I always wanted to be a journalist. That's all I wanted to do. And it's an important lesson, Giles, to learn in how you speak to young people and how you encourage them, which is why I think, you know, this podcast is particularly useful for people to listen to. I always wanted to be a journalist. It's all I ever wanted to do. And then when I was at university, I went to one of those open evenings where you go and speak to people. You know, I've done them myself at a number of universities now to try and give something back about, you know, our industry. And there happened to be a journalist there from The Guardian doing a how to get a job in journalism evening. And I waited behind afterwards with all my clever questions, you know, wanting very feverishly excited to talk to this person. And I said, hello, you know, I really want a job in journalism. It's all I've ever wanted to do. And he said, well, what university newspaper do you write for here in Oxford? And I said, I don't write for them. And he said, well, you've got no chance, mate. No one's going to give you a job. And of course, I subsequently now know that's utter tut. Millions of friends of mine have got jobs in amazing papers, you know, quite often with zero experience whatsoever. And it is a bit easier these days with writing your own blogs and various things. But I just assumed he was telling the truth. And I never even considered journalism ever again. I just thought I didn't have a chance. So I went to the careers service to think about what else I should do. And there are two theories from this point as to how I ended up in advertising. There's the truth, which is I did one of those computer programs to let you know what you should do. And it said I should go into advertising or publishing. And I didn't know what publishing was, so I presumed advertising. Genuinely true, that is. I had no idea what publishing was. All my friends reckoned that the reason I got into advertising was because I was too lazy to get past A in the careers service dictionary. It isn't wonderful. Actually true, but that's what they all went. That's why we had to go through a series of A to Z binders, jobs to get. And they just reckon I was so lazy, I just chose one beginning with A.
Well, listen, you're a fan of storytelling, and that is a lovely story.
The first one is true. I didn't know what publishers did. I now know what publishers do, but I didn't, you know, for about 2 decades. But yeah.
Amazing. And just a nod to that encyclopedic brain of yours. So prior to making that call to go into advertising, I've seen in our research that there were certain ads, largely BBH work from the 80s and 90s,
yeah,
that seems to hold a special place in your brain, in your recall. One of them being Levi's Creek ad, which I watched again probably for the first time in about a decade last week off the back of this research.
Yeah, I mean, BBH work of the sort of mid to late 80s, particularly the Levi's work, was something I think that affected everybody of my generation, whether you choose to like ads or not, in the sense that, you know, it was sort of, if Levi's chose to put your music on their ad, it made number one. You know,
yep.
Even Babylon Zoo, you know, something as ridiculously rubbish as that, you know, ended up, you know, through being on, being number one. So I suppose the first time I saw Levi's Creek, you know, I'd sort of decided at this point I quite fancied a job in advertising. This was 1993. I'm being hopelessly arrogant, as I think you only can be when you're about 18, 19 years old. I decided I was only going to apply to the top five advertising agencies in the country, because what was the point in not working for one of those?
Yeah.
And so Levi's Creek, kind of, first off, just is a piece of pure filmmaking storytelling that just happens to be an ad. So, you know, I think it was Alex Bukowski who said that thing about people don't, it might not have been, you'll correct me if it isn't, but he was saying, you know, people don't like ads. They sort of, they watch what they like, and sometimes that happens to be an ad.
Yes. I've seen that attributed to Howard Gossage.
Oh, it may have been originally, and maybe Bukowski stole it, but, you know, yeah. I'm sure, you know, with all credits. Creek I saw and just thought, it just affected me so amazingly, you know, from its editing to its music. It was absolutely fantastic. I was saying that the reason it also plays a sort of weirdly special part in my advertising career trajectory was I'd been told, I was invited for an open day at Ogilvy in 1993, and very few people were. You know, it was like, I think it was only 25 people were invited along. You had to apply for it. And so I went along. And I'd been told by somebody, I don't know why I listen to people, but I'd been told by somebody that Ogilvy never, ever showed you examples of ads that weren't done by them. So they played Levi's Creek as part of this open day to sort of talk us through how you made ads. And so for about the next 3 months, when I applied for jobs, I just kept saying my favorite ad was Ogilvy's Levi's Creek ad. Which clearly anyone who received my letter, it proved that I was a complete moron. Now these days, you could just Google who did Levi's Creek, but back then,
yeah.
And so I think possibly Levi's Creek was responsible for me not getting a job in advertising for about half a year.
And then when you did start working in advertising, if we go back to the Shambles agency just quickly, what were you actually doing within the agency? The reason I ask is because there seems to be quite a pattern. We've recorded, I think this is our 150th episode, and there are names that have immediately popped into my mind, including the likes of Orlando Wood and Will Humphries, who had a similar path, if you zoom out enough, of going to a prestigious university. You went to Oxford, studying history specifically, and then finding their way in account management roles, and then more recently moving on to different roles, typically strategic roles.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd one. My first two agencies didn't have planners. There were no planners in the agency. There was no strategy department, so I didn't even know it existed. I mean, it tended to be that most people went in via account management because that was the volume of jobs. You know, 90% of jobs were in account management. You know, there weren't entry-level jobs in creative. You know, you needed a portfolio, etc., or the ability to be able to write or draw, which I could do neither. Actually, I could write, but not, you know, not in the sort of focused skill, craft skill of advertising writing. So that's how I got in through account management. You sort of applied for grad jobs, and most grad jobs were account management. I mean, the answer to your question, what did you do there, is doubly hilarious. because I didn't really understand how an ad agency worked, hence why I got sacked from my first one, probably, I kind of just went in and made myself useful. So just said, you know, what do you want me to do? So it started off with me being in account handling, but because the agency was a bit shambolic, you sort of had to do everything. So, I mean, if I told you some of the things I did in my first 6 months, I wrote a telly ad that ended up on telly because the creative director was having a bit of a paddy and sort of said, you know, because the client kept making changes, sort of said to me, well, if you like the client so much, why don't you write it? So I did, and the client bought it. I art directed a photo shoot with Ryan Giggs because I didn't realize you were supposed to take art directors with you. So Ryan, could you just get up that ladder? And we were about the same age, me and Ryan. What else did I do when I was there? Everything. I mean, literally everything. Production, account handling, writing, art direction. I didn't know any better. In some ways, it was the greatest education ever because you just throw yourself in. My grandma, who left school at the age of 11 to be a domestic servant, you know, proper Downton Abbey stuff, in the 20s, you know, she always used to say to me, you'll never get anywhere in life, Kev, being clever. You know, also, people don't like clever people. They like useful people, you know. And so I found it was better just to walk around the agency asking people what they needed help with.
Mm.
You know, that was much better than sort of trying to sit in a box. I mean, then when I went to my job after that was to go to Ogilvy as an account manager. And there you were very much in a lane. You know, that's what you did. You didn't. And what was very curious to me in that job was Ogilvy was very split at the time between Ogilvy Direct and Ogilvy and Mather. And I went into Ogilvy Direct to do direct marketing, but which then very quickly became digital. And then my first planning job was actually at O&M. And they were even in different offices. One was in Smithfield, one was in Canary Wharf. You know, everyone in Smithfield used to dismissively refer to Canary Wharf as Budgie Bay. You know, and everybody who worked in Canary Wharf thought that anybody who didn't work in advertising just wasn't worth talking to. You know, above the line advertising, I mean. So, what did I do in my first sort of ad role? Sort of everything. And it gave me... what this short sort of should teach people about the early part of their career, I think, is just... I've mentored a lot of people and I get asked a lot by people, I really want a job in PR, but I've been offered a job in media. Should I take it? You know, my advice to everybody in this industry is whatever job you get offered, take it. You know, because it's easier to get a job from a job. It's all experience. It's all applicable, you know, and transferable as skill. You know, and as Damon Albarn once said, you know, nothing is wasted, right?
Yeah.
You should just take the job and then learn on it and do stuff. So probably my first two jobs, you know, it was probably as circuitous and tangential as it was ever possible to be to get a job as an account planner, ultimately. But I found that everything I did and everything I learned was useful. And why wouldn't it be?
Yeah, there's a line I think I've quoted before, and I believe it came from Dave Trott, but it's something along the lines of the best people in advertising know a lot of stuff about a lot of stuff. And I think that approach to accepting work, even if it's not what your preconceived self think is the right role, can only lead to more education or more experiences or something that ultimately will serve you well.
Yeah, I think it'd be very useful if Dave sort of applied that to himself sometimes about things that weren't of the line advertising, but yeah.
And then at some point I'm mindful, I don't want this to just become, you know, too chronological. So I'll try it. It doesn't matter if it does, but I don't want to push you through every single role you went to, because at some point you now, I suppose, latterly reflect specifically on certain qualities, creativity obviously being one of them. And it's interesting to me that even when you spoke about the Levi's Creek ad, I like the way you explained it as great filmmaking and great storytelling that just happened to be an ad. So when you talk about creativity, do you talk about creativity not necessarily in the context of advertising?
Creativity is one of those words that is wildly open to interpretation and therefore wildly open to misinterpretation.
Yes.
So don't get me wrong, right? Creative executional skill sets are vital and very specific. Okay. So when you say, or when I say that everyone can be creative, what I don't mean is that everyone has the ability to execute creatively. You know, despite what Michael Gove might think, I don't think we have had enough of experts. So if you want somebody to write an advert, then you need to get somebody who can write an advert. You know, there are very, very clear executional craft skills involved in our industry, regardless of what your unit of creativity is, whether that be film, whether that be poster, whether that be web, whether that be social, whatever, right? When I talk about creative, and I talk about it a lot with Mick in the book, and we're writing a second book now about creativity as a life skill, what I'm talking about is, if you look up the word creative in a dictionary, it basically just says new and original thinking. So the ability to think creatively, regardless of what you do for a living, is a vital skill. Now, it's a vital skill in life, not just in the creative industries. So, you know, the World Economic Forum just identified creativity and creative thinking as the most important factor in business success in the future. UNICEF have just identified creativity as one of the core skills that children will need for life. So they're probably the two most diametrically opposed organizations in the World Economic Forum and UNICEF, both think creativity is the most vital life skill. So, you know, the ability to think differently. I'm always astonished when I hear anybody in business, and you hear it from chief execs, you hear it from founders all the time, people who say, well, I'm not the creative one. You know, I'm not very creative. And I find it astonishing. Would they ever sit in front of the city, a journalist, their organization, their client, and tell them they didn't believe in being different or original or innovative? No, they wouldn't. And that's all that creative means. So,
yeah.
You know, like I say, you have to separate creative, unfortunately, in our industry, you know, is occasionally meant and applied to mean a job title or a department. And that's not what it is. Okay.
Yep.
When it comes to executional skill and craft, of course it is. I mean, one of the stories I would tell you, very telling for me about the book that Mick and I wrote, was we've had nothing since writing the book, but incredible support and counsel and encouragement from everybody that I've met, right? You know, it's been astonishing and humbling and brilliant and whatever word you want to use, right? From everyone in the industry and outside. Apart from one person who I'm not going to name, but who is somebody within the industry. And when this person was asked if they could do a testimonial or endorse the book, this person, if you did know it was, you know, we would very much surprise you. This person said that they couldn't in good conscience endorse the book because it would encourage clients to think that they could write their own creative work. And the reason I thought that was incredibly telling and disappointing was this person couldn't imagine the word creative being used in any context at all, apart from somebody in an advertising agency writing adverts in a creative department. Like they couldn't even, their brain couldn't even get around the idea that creativity wasn't about adverts or above the line or an ad agency, whereas we all know that creativity is simply the ability to think differently. And everybody can do that. Apart from, there's only one career where you're not allowed to say you're creative, and it's accountancy, because the term creative accountancy means criminality,
fraud.
Yeah. So I've always said that. There's always an exception, and the exception is accountancy, where you're not allowed to be creative. You can be you can think differently and innovatively. You just can't call it creativity.
Yeah, I think, firstly, that's well said, but I also think it's really important to create those two different interpretations of what you mean by the word creative.
Yeah, never get me wrong. I am not... The skill, the individual craft, right? When I watch it, I am in bewildered awe of the creative leap, of where people's minds can go, of the kind of people that can write Cadbury's eyebrows, you know. And I was lucky enough to work with the guy who wrote it. But, you know, when I sit in a room with people like Mick Mahoney or Chris Groom or Sam Heath, you know, these people who can look at a brief I write and jump, you know, from point A to point Z plus in a way that my brain would never, ever, ever, ever be able to do. That is where you bring in an expert. Okay, that is where you can't do it yourself. It's why the majority of in-house agencies aren't agencies, they're studios, and they still need the executional or specific skills of strategy or creativity brought in from outside. A lot of times they don't, but, you know, don't get me wrong, the distinction between creative executional craft and creative thinking is what I'm talking about.
Well, your business partner and co-author, Mick, says you can be creative in any field you're in, even if that's a big muddy field. So if we go into that a bit more, are you talking, as I would understand, you mean, for example, breaking conventions and category norms in the context of advertising?
Yes. I mean, you know, I think that line you just said from Mick is a perfect illustration of what I was just talking about. I wrote Mick about 4 pages of strategic whatever about what I thought around the fact that you could bring creativity to whatever you're doing. And then Mick wrote that devastatingly brilliant line about you can bring it to any field, even a big muddy field.
Yeah, it's lovely.
That's why he's a copywriter. That's why he, you know, has more lions than Longleat. It's why, you know, he won the Grand Prix at Cannes when he was about 9 years old or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the difference. So yes, that is really what I'm talking about. You know, not just in advertising, but in everything. But when you think about advertising, yes, of course. So the brain, you know, this is really obvious and very basic science. The brain is only trained to notice the noticeably different. It's because back in evolution, everything was going to kill you. So your brain had to edit out anything extraneous to focus on the immediate threat. Now, it's still doing that every second of every day, despite the fact that those threats don't exist in the modern world. But what the brain is trained to do is to forget and to basically edit out anything that it's seen before. So if you just show it all the usual tropes, everything it's seen before, and just present to it all the usual boring crap of a category, it won't notice, because it can't notice, because 50,000 years of evolution, you know, has taught your brain not to notice. So if you're going to be noticed, the first law of advertising, then you're going to have to be interesting. You're going to have to be different, which is why if you do that, even if you're not particularly wacky or out there, you'll get yourself ahead of 95% of advertising in the world. And I think people often think doing things differently, or when you talk about doing things creatively or differently, you're talking about, you know, going completely out there. You're not. You're just talking about identifying the category tropes and doing something different. And that can be delivered in, you know, quite what I suppose a lot of people would consider to be quite a normal and, you know, quite pedestrian way, if you like, as long as it's different. You know, being dull will cost you a fortune as an advertiser because of how much money you'll have to spend to get noticed. It always comes back to me. I always remember that amazing line that Sigourney Weaver used in her high school yearbook. You know, you write those lines in the yearbook in America, and she just said, "Please God, don't let me be ordinary."
Amazing.
That's just one of the most wonderful lines of all time.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. And I find it quite baffling how... I also actually... That's kind of led to a separate question on the same topic is... the bit about breaking category norms and trying to be different slash distinct, I think one of the issues is we perceive that to be brave, to stand out and be distinct.
Yeah.
I gave a talk with Ryan Woolman a few years ago, and the headline was effectively, "Don't be brave, be right." Because it's more about understanding that it's the right thing to do from a commercial perspective. But I think, again, you brought up evolution earlier. I think for evolutionary reasons, perhaps as human beings, there is this urge to blend in and this kind of pack mentality of safety. But when you apply that same logic to creating a brand and effectively advertising yourself, it's almost the opposite rules apply.
Yeah, I think brave is another word, a little bit like creative, that is much misinterpreted and therefore so it can be very differently interpreted and therefore can be much misinterpreted. You know, people often think brave means reckless, and that's a very different thing. Humans are naturally averse to risk. Of course we are. We have six primary emotions, five of them are negative, and the reason for that's what kept us alive, right? The other thing is, of course, that in evolution, all the people who were particularly brave slash reckless all died. So all your genes in your body are cowardly custard genes. You know what I mean? They're all the people who hid behind the rock while someone else went and did it. People who thought, I wonder what will happen if I eat that blueberry, all died. So therefore, all right, don't eat blueberries. So I think that's the thing. Bravery, first off, is much misinterpreted. It doesn't mean being reckless. You know, it means taking calculated risks based on data. Not 100% of data, as Margaret Hefferman would tell you, 80% of data and then go for it. But I think the other part of bravery is what every piece of data will tell you is that being boring and fitting in and normal and safe in an advertising context won't get you noticed. So in many ways, the bravest slash stupidest slash most suicidal thing you can do as a marketer is to just do something dull and ordinary.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually not brave to do something different because it's been empirically proven to be the thing that will save you the most money and be most effective. So actually, it's the opposite.
You're preaching to the converted here. Absolutely. And there's a few tricks in the book, which I really like, because I think, and you've touched on this in your TED talk, which, you know, wow, was 13 years ago now, I believe. But I watched that yesterday and I found it really interesting, especially talking about different stages of your life. And as children, we're typically more creative because we don't have that kind of conformity or pressure to conform. And I feel like to be so later in life, you almost have to consciously work on it, whereas it's completely subconscious as children. But some of the tips in the book are wonderful. Bringing one person you don't usually work with to a meeting, I love that. Is that for that very reason, that they're not going to be as familiar with that what to conform to, and they might be able to ask silly questions, we might call them?
Yeah, I mean, there was something in the front door of Wieden & Kennedy when I worked there. You walked in and every day there was a sign on the left-hand side when you walked in the door which said, "Walk in stupid every day."
Perfect.
And it's really wonderful principle because it's funny. Again, on that thing, if you only notice the noticeably different, which is a behavioral science principle called the von Restorff effect, you have to, if I showed you, you know, a painting you'd never seen before, you'd notice something within it that I hadn't. And I think it's something, if you don't know the questions to ask, you will ask loads of questions. And I don't believe in stupid questions. I don't think there are any stupid questions, because if there is a question, it probably means you've left something slightly open. And I like this idea of bringing someone in. You know, if you took me to a conference on architecture, you know, I'd have a few questions that probably they hadn't thought of, because it's not my world. And I think you can always learn from people who aren't part. And then the ad industry over the years has become really bad at this. You know, I get increasingly frustrated by this really weird nostalgia bias in our industry. I keep noticing all this sort of, you know, grumpy old people, normally grumpy old men, just writing posts all the time about how it's not as good as the good old days. And if I go back to when I first started advertising, another set of grumpy old men were writing those articles then, and that was 30 years ago, you know, and it's just people who've sort of haven't really looked outside for a while. And, you know, things do change, and it's good to get people in who think differently. You know, if this might be the only time in my life, Giles, I ever quote a Korean proverb at you. they have this proverb that says the frog in the well never sees the ocean. You know, and I think it's that thing of you just got to look outside, different stimulus, talk to people. You know, what you mentioned TED. You know, I went to the TED conference every year, you know, the main one in, used to be in Los Angeles and then moved to Vancouver. I went every year for 10 years, which meant I saw 1,300 TED Talks live, you know, and the amount of people I met who just did fascinating and different and interesting things, nothing like I did. You know, I wouldn't have even been able to start to even contemplate how to do what they did. And it's fascinating. Just go and talk to people who don't do what you do and you will earn, you know, an awful lot. And I always loved that walking stupid every day, because otherwise what happens is, it's something else we cover in the book in chapter 2, which is, you know, received wisdom is the worst wisdom to receive. You know, we've done that. We've tried that. We did that before. That doesn't work. People in this category don't do things that way. Young people don't watch TV. You know, posters aren't a direct response mechanism. Blah, 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 blah. People just tell you these things all the time. You know, and on average, if you've read the book Lie Spotting, you know, we're on average lied to between 50 and 200 times a day, right? Sometimes accidentally, occasionally malevolently, but, you know, just challenge all the time, because categories fall into lazy tropes and advertisers fall into lazy tropes using the same words in the same things in the same ways. And just the best thing to do is just to break those tropes. I think one category that's really lovely to look at that does this quite often is the luxury category. You know, you think it's very traditional, but it's brands like Burberry and Coco Chanel and Louis Vuitton that are kind of embracing things like Web3, the metaverse, you know, virtual catwalks, et cetera, et cetera. It's the luxury brands that really understand how to come across on TikTok. You know, it's interesting. Just challenge convention. You know, I was fascinated by a huge high-end luxury brand that's at the top end of kind of price. And I'm talking, you know, 5-6 figures purchase price. The client told me his number one most effective marketing channel was Facebook display.
Wow.
I was like, what, running Meta ads? He's like, yeah, it would really surprise you, wouldn't it? People making $10,000 purchases off the back of a Facebook display ad. You know, and I, in my conventional wisdom, would have been, what a waste of time. You shouldn't be in that space because it's not premium, because it's not a direct response, because it's a high involvement purchase, etc., etc. Nope. Now, of course, in classic long and short of it thinking, they also did huge amounts of sort of peacocking, you know, costly signaling above the line. But where they converted was Facebook display.
Yeah, I can believe that. It's not dissimilar, I suppose, to the surprising to some volume of online car sales when you think about the, you know, the value you're talking.
It's a great example, Giles, because years ago, you know, and I'm not talking many years ago, I'm talking a decade ago, you know, having to convince an auto client of mine that he should be using social. Clients telling me, don't come down here and waste my time talking about Facebook, you know. I don't want, you know, it's a channel for teenagers to tell each other what they had for breakfast. You know, and all this ever changed, by the way. I started off doing digital marketing in 1997. I was part of a four-person committee at Ogilvy called the Work the Web Committee. Exec sponsor was Rory Sutherland. And the four of us had to convince people in Ogilvy that the web was going to catch on. You know, it was going to affect our business. Ogilvy Interactive at the time had 2 employees. 18 months later, it had 250 employees, you know, during the first dot-com hype cycle. And the point I want to make about it is about all that changes is the name that you slide into this next sentence. Because I have clients always saying, don't come and talk to me about the internet. You know, it's just a waste of time. Don't come and talk to me about Facebook. Don't come and talk to me about Twitter. Don't come and talk to me about Instagram. Don't talk to me about TikTok. Don't talk to me about mobile. Don't talk to me about metaverse. Don't talk to me about AI. Everybody just thinks, you know, this stuff won't affect them. And it does. And it just becomes, it becomes part of the media conversation and landscape. And it isn't the silly hype cycle of everything's going to die now because of this.
Yeah.
It's how does the introduction of this affect the marketing mix?
Yeah. I'm just, so you know, I kind of exist between 2 contradictory points where, number one, I believe it, new technology obviously can be overhyped. But number two, and this is probably more pivotal and a nod to what you've just been saying, is no one wants to be the guy that says they don't believe in electricity. Like it will fundamentally become part of the fabric of your life.
Yeah,
and
but
culture.
Electricity is a great point, right? So I've always hated the term digital native. I don't consider myself to be an electricity native. I just grew up in a world where electricity was very normal and surrounded me all the time. In the same way that the next generation, or my son's generation, who's 22, has been surrounded by social for pretty much his whole life. The generation before has been surrounded by the web for pretty much their entire adult life. So in that sense, like I say, I'm not an electricity native. One of the best books to read on this is a book by a guy called Tom Standage called The Victorian Internet. And it's basically a book around the introduction of the electric telegraph in the 1850s. And if you read even the sentences that we used about it, it's a web of ideas. You know, all the stuff, it was basically written that this was going to change everything in the world, and it did. But it only changed in the sense that it was another medium. And then the radio came along. The cinema came along, and then the radio came along, and then someone put the two together and made television and talkies, you know, and then mass market publishing came along. And then, you know, what then happens, you know, video, you know, which weirdly didn't kill the radio star, did it? You know, the video's disappeared, a radio seems in rude health. You know, and then, you know, the web came along, and then mobile came along, and then social came along. And, you know, I refuse to believe in this silly the future is or the death of binary narrative. You know, it does affect what we do, and you can't ignore it, but it adds to what we do. I mean, the analogy that I often use, when a new media comes along, it's a little bit like an uninvited guest at a dinner party. You know, no one was expecting them. No one's prepared a plate for them. It's all a bit awkward. Everyone gets really worried that they're going to steal their food. And then they kind of just, everyone kind of budges up and, you know, everyone gets a little bit off everyone's plate, and then the hubbub settles down, and then everyone goes back, you know, and yeah,
that's a great analogy. That's brilliant.
Of course, some people will die. Some people will fall out, you know. But what I've noticed over the years is brilliant businesses who understand what their customers want tend to survive. You know, what happens in a kind of Darwinian way is, you know, the classic, the evolution of media acts like the evolution of anything.
Yeah.
You know, the weak fall by the wayside. You know, the smart and the adaptable succeed.
I think seeing it as an evolution is actually spot on rather than the death of. And I think my favourite quote that talks about our kind of weird obsession with media dying, I believe it was Tess Alps when she was at Thinkbox, which is TV is not dying, it's having babies.
Spot on. I mean,
which kind of nods to the evolutionary thinking rather than the death one, right?
time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod-listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
My first sort of proper paid weekly job was a holiday job as a student, which was driving a forklift truck at the Ribena factory.
Ah, Call to Action, episode 11, with the one and only Rory Sutherland. Not what we were looking for, but hang on a minute.
We actually have a brilliant listener question, which is kind of going to allow you to elaborate on this point. So I might move there now, if you don't mind.
Of course.
So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger, but that's not stopped us asking. So a question from Mark Earls, who I believe you're...
I do know Mark very well, yeah.
Know Mark very well. Mark says, you are clearly one of the best planning brains in town, but also one of the most enthusiastic voices in the industry. To what extent do you think enthusiasm for your clients, for your audience, and for the solution helps you?
Well, as ever, Mark asked a great question. I'd just have left it at that bit where he said I was a great planner. But anyway, no, I think, look, I'm endlessly fascinated by everything in the world, okay? And I do think enthusiasm is an absolutely vital thing, right? And I'm not just talking about a sort of Tigger-esque sort of excitement. I mean, I am in some way quite lucky in the sense that I am actually medically autistic. You know, I am actually diagnosed as autistic. And there's an interesting thing. I don't believe that autism is a superpower. I sort of very much am anti that view because I know how difficult sometimes it is to deal with the condition and various things. But I do believe, obviously, neurodiversity gives you a different way of looking at things, which is very useful, hence why we should encourage people, you know, into the industry and who are neurodiverse. But when you are neurodiverse, particularly if you have autism and what was known as Asperger's in the old days, you suffer from a principle called monotropism, where you tend to get very focused and latched onto things, and it's very difficult to break the cycle. What that can be very difficult, obviously, in autistic children or in mood swings and various things, getting people to break out of them. But where it's very useful in what we do here is if I'm given a question or a topic or a category, probably for about 12 hours, I find it the most endlessly fascinating and exciting topic I've ever heard in my entire life. And I am monotropically focused on it. And so it's very useful as a planner that I just find the world endlessly interesting. And it really is fascinating and exciting. And I get infused by what a lot of people might think are the most stupid things. So A, I think enthusiasm is a very, very useful skill to have. But then this is where I would get in. And anyone who's listening who wants to be a planner or a strategist, and I happen to think those two things are exactly the same, and I find the debate between the two words endlessly dull. If you want to be a planner or a strategist, your job is only one single thing. It's to separate the useful from the interesting. The whole world is interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff out there. And if you're looking at a topic, you know, whether it's how to sell cars or why do people eat certain brands of baked beans or why people should go on holiday in Jamaica or whatever it is, whatever question you're being asked, then there will be lots of interesting things you'll find out. And your natural tendency would be to want to tell everybody about them because you want to prove how clever you are. But all great strategies are not defined by what you choose to put in them. They're defined by what you leave out of them to let the useful stuff breathe. And so enthusiasm, you're probably gathering from the tone of my voice, is absolutely necessary in whatever you're doing. Because you know, it's great, but then you've got to separate the useful from the interesting. That's the planner's skill. I think probably practically as well, if you're enthused by something, time goes quicker.
Yes.
You know, so you'll just find that you'll be living in a world where, you know, like flow theory, where basically every hour feels like a minute and you'll just enjoy yourself more. And Christ, isn't that a better life?
Yeah. Well, it was a fantastic question, but I think you've done that question justice with your answer.
And Mark is equally a very enthusiastic person and loves what he talks about, you know, and that's why, you know, people listen to him and why people should listen to him.
Yeah. Hear, hear. Question two from Anne. Anne says, you recently spoke on LinkedIn about the power of a confident brand. How can a brand show confidence, and how do you stop it slipping into arrogance?
Okay. First off, confidence is just having a point of view. Okay. Most brands don't have a point of view. And if you don't have a point of view, you're an ornament. Okay. You can just be ignored. I mean, you should have a point of view on your category, your product, or your service and put it out there. Right. That's how you show confidence. You show confidence by doing fewer things better. You know, don't scattergun everything. Just, you know, pick one or two things and do them. But there's one very, very important difference between confidence and arrogance. And I've occasionally been accused of being arrogant because I've said I'm very good at what I do. I am very good at what I do. That's why clients use me. It's why I have good testimonials. And I can prove I'm good at what I do. So confidence is validated. Arrogance is assumption. That's the difference. By the way, confident brands, there is, and if anyone wants to write to me and ask me for the references, there are the most ridiculous amount of scientific papers from the 1950s through to the present day on why people buy from confident people. Confidence begats confidence, right? People buy from confident people. There's an interesting behavioral science principle called the red sneaker effect that also proves that you can look up. But I think confidence, if you're confident in yourself or your product or your service and you can prove it and you act with confidence, it is seductive and very, very, very attractive and proven to be incredibly effective. But it has to be validated. Otherwise, if you just turn up and say, TV's dead or young people don't watch telly anymore, you know, we all know the kind of podcasts, you know, the kind of idiots who preach those lies. And that's just arrogance and that's assumption and that can't be validated. So that's what I would say. Get out there. If you're good and you know you're good and you can prove you're good, that's individually, or as a business, if you know what you do is good and you can prove it's good, then just get out there and get on the front foot.
Yeah, I think that validation is key, but I don't think I'd necessarily considered it that way before. Nice. Good answer. So, Kevin, the final part of our interview is our four pertinent poses. Starting with number one, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I think there's two bits I would give. I'm going to add three, and the third one's only slightly tongue-in-cheek.
Go on, yeah.
The first one would be, I would just want to tell him that it's going to be okay. I think people need to hear that, you know, particularly in 2024 with everything that's going on, with the uncertainty ripple from global to local to family to life to you. You know, I think I'd love just to tell my 18-year-old self, it's going to be okay, you know, just, it's going to be fine. The second thing I would be is I just wouldn't be so hard on myself. I think we are very hard on ourselves when we're younger. And I think sometimes we get less hard on ourselves as we get older because we realize that everyone's making it up. And then the other piece of advice I wish someone had told me when I was younger was that probably just to shower more often. I think teenage boys need to learn that people like people who smell nice, whether that be, you know, whether your partner is a boy or your partner is a girl, that people like people who smell nice. So, yeah, I think I'd probably give my younger self that piece of advice.
Hygiene. Yeah. Well, I know that hasn't come up before because I would have remembered. So that's great. It's great having unique advice. I think being okay and don't be so hard on yourself. I think the fact that has come up fairly frequently is actually a good thing and just reinforces what good advice it is.
This is going to sound so trite, but just where you can be nice.
Sure.
You know, it's just, I've learned that, I think, as I've got older as well. The amount of times And sometimes I blame my autism, but my wife always says that, you know, your autism explains your behavior, Kev. It doesn't excuse it.
That's wonderful.
So, wonderful. You know, where it's all possible, you know, your natural tendency will be to be snarky or sarky or to leap in. And I think social media encourages this with the algorithms. But just where possible, just help people out and just be nice to people. God, it makes you feel better if you want to be selfish about it.
Yeah. If you need a selfish angle, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. Well, number two then, that kind of plays to this in part. If you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
Okay, I banish the hubris of people who say they don't believe in brand. Okay. Mm-hmm. So my biggest frustration, I've often jokingly said that the role of the modern planner is simply to turn up and represent the long and the short of it every 3 weeks.
Yes.
So whenever I've had to present the case for brand or for investing in emotionally led storytelling, I've had to turn up with binders and binders and binders full of evidence. And it's all proven. It's all empirically proven. It's all there, right? Endless proof that this is effective and the right way to go. The case for the prosecution just has to turn up with like two lines off a podcast or just a hubristic shrug and say, well, I don't believe in it. You know, and I'm absolutely astonished. That's what I would ban. I would ban the sort of hubristic arrogance of people who don't really understand how the human brain works.
Well, again, I'm almost certain that hasn't come up before, but I think that's arguably my favourite ever answer to question two. Because, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I find myself doing that time and time again. And you're right. Why should the onus be on us to prove it when it's evidence? Number three, you've already mentioned the Victorian internet. Are there any other books that you would recommend to our listeners?
Do you mean apart from The Creative Nudge by Kevin Chest?
And of course, we will link to, I assure you.
There are two books, actually, that I return to time and time again. And interestingly, neither of them are probably what you would say would be traditional business titles.
That's good. Yeah.
I may add a third at the end, actually, which I think is more of a useful book for a lot of people. The first one is Legacy by James Kerr, which is the 15 lessons you can learn in life from studying the All Blacks.
Okay.
Now, I don't particularly like rugby, but it's a fascinating story of the most successful sports team of all time and what you can learn from them. Very, very useful. And the other one, and I was lucky enough to meet Chris, who's a lovely and very generous man, Chris Hadfield's book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And it's basically, he's the guy who used to run the International Space Center. Space Station, sorry. He's a NASA astronaut. Astronauts are fascinating people if you meet them, right? I once met a guy who walked on the moon, Jim Irwin. It's like, cause there aren't many of them, right? I mean, so Chris Hadfield wrote this book, which basically is everything he learnt in space and how to apply it to your daily life on Earth. And it's absolutely fascinating. The other book that I would get everybody to read is a book called The Rebuilders by Sarah Tate and Anna Vogt. It started off as a podcast. Other podcasts are available, obviously, Josh. But and it's basically about everybody has knocks in life. Everyone has things that don't go right, failures, whatever, right? Whether it's about a business or about your job or about a meeting or whatever, right? And it's basically the science of rebuilding. And I revisit it all the time. And it is one of the most inspiring and useful titles you will ever read, because we all mess up, right? As Roger Federer said, though, you know, in that wonderful speech he gave about a month ago, you know, it's just a point, right? Whether you hit the greatest forehand in the world or you hit a double fault, it's still just a point. Move on, play the next one. Do you know what I mean? And I think The Rebuilders is a wonderful book, and everyone should read it.
Amazing. Well, we had Sarah on a couple of years ago post-launch to promote The Rebuilders, and I have read that, and I will echo your recommendation if it wasn't heard clearly the first time. So we will include links to The Creative Nudge, which I do urge everybody to buy. The Victorian Internet, just because that sounds fascinating, albeit I accept it wasn't an official recommendation. Legacy, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And of course, The Rebuilders, which I just mentioned. Amazing. Great books. We always dedicate every episode to someone. So this is number 4, Kevin. Would you do the honour of dedicating this episode to somebody?
I'm going to cheat again, because I always think as a planner, you can actually repurpose the brief. I'm going to say 2 people. The first one is my wife, who I never really understood the joking term, my better half, until I met her. Or if you imagine I'm irritating now, you should have met me before I met her. She
poor woman.
She helped iron out the more irritating and destructive elements of my personality and amplify the good bits, and also taught me how to be kind. And the other one is my mum, who was my inspiration for writing the book, and who taught me that I could do whatever it is I wanted to do in my life, regardless of where I started, or just always taught me you can do it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, they're amazing, amazing dedications. So this episode is very proudly dedicated to, firstly, the woman who said Kevin's autism might explain his behaviour, but it doesn't excuse it. That is your wife. And again, very loudly and proudly to your mum. So as a final call to action, this episode listing will contain links to Kevin's book, The Creative Nudge. We'll include links to the other books we've discussed and the recommendations, The Victorian Internet, Legacy, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and of course, Sarah Tate's wonderful book. She co-wrote The Rebuilders. Thank you so much for guesting. Thank you for giving us Walking Stupid Every Day, The Frog in the Well Never Sees the Ocean, and obviously so much more. How else can our listeners get more Kevin Chesters?
I've spent, 30 years of my life working for companies. I now work for myself. But the other thing I do is I run a series of 10 training modules for clients, for agencies, for in-house agencies, in how to make yourself more excellent in all sorts of different ways. So if you want to take a look and contact me, you can find me at kevinchesters.com.
So yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege, Kevin. Thanks for coming on the show.
No worries, mate.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email The Mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
Try, and I try, and I try.